man is your man. This man is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This man was made, you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, Episode 15. We're recording this on Sunday, December 8th, 2019. So continuing our series on leftist history in the United States, especially lesser-known leftist history, we're going to be talking about some of the opposition to World War One within the United States, the American participation specifically. This is obviously a fairly broad topic, but there were some specific areas that were of particular interest to us for this week's episode. We're going to start out by talking about the Green Corn Rebellion in Oklahoma in 1917. So again, as we've talked about on recent episodes, just to recap the timeline here, the United States officially enters World War One in the spring of 1917. The war has been going for several years at that point, with fairly catastrophic human toll for most of the participants. I think a lot of people in the United States were quite aware of that, so you can imagine why some of them were not super keen to go volunteer to be in the trenches over there. And then it takes the United States quite a while, because we had a small standing army when the decision to enter the war was made. It takes quite a while to draft enough people, train them, etc., and transport them to actually get them put into action. A lot of U.S. troops didn't really see much action until 1918, the final year of the war. Over the course of 1917, there were significant attempts by opponents of U.S. participation to try to resist the draft process and generally resist the war effort, which was starting to spin up. We've also talked in past episodes of our show about things like the U.S. nationalization of railroads and so forth. There was a lot going on. We also talked, of course, about the anarchist and IWW opposition to the war, but we're going to focus right now on the Green Corn Rebellion in Oklahoma in 1917. There was a great Smithsonian Magazine article about that earlier this year, which was one reason that we decided to cover this. We've also looked at a number of other sources that had some interesting other alternative angles on it as well. But let's get into this first by talking about the situation with farmers in Oklahoma and why they were sort of ripe for potential revolutionary action. I'll go to Nate first and then Rachel after that. Nate, talk to me a little bit about the situation for farmers in Oklahoma at the time.
Okay, yeah. So a lot of the reason that the Green Corn Rebellion found support was because there was a large population of tenant farmers, and I guess we'll get to it, but the leadership of the Green Corn Rebellion sort of eschewed Marxist sort of orthodoxy when it comes to collectivization and like land holding, by basically appealing to these in debt small holders and basically saying, oh yeah, you guys, you know, you're sympathetic to our cause, you can get on board with us. So a lot of times they were doing 20% interest was the baseline, but it could go up to 200%, was not uncommon, and some of the highest compound rates reached 2,000%. And there was basically rock bottom prices for cotton, and so the tenant farmers were very highly leveraged, had no choice but to sell and then mortgage the next year's crop to keep going. And then there was also large amounts of poor soil conditions and the periodic ravages of the pestilential boll weevil, as the article says. So basically, yeah, no matter how thrifty they were basically trapped in a perpetual debt cycle and poverty, and this sort of led them to being sympathetic to members of the WCU, working class union, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, so in 1915, a year and a half or so before this uprising happens, there were more registered Socialist Party members in Oklahoma, which was a relatively recently added state, than in all of New York State. which of course had seven times the population and a much stronger tradition of left-wing politics, as the Smithsonian notes. Oklahoma socialists built a statewide movement, but won most of the converts in the southeastern counties, where a small elite of predominantly white landowners had established a cotton fiefdom in the old Indian territory. They rented out most of their land to tenant farmers, black or white, who had migrated from Texas, Arkansas, and the Deep South to Oklahoma, dreaming of an opportunity on a new frontier. Now, to Nate's point about this issue of Marxist orthodoxy, Rachel, do you want to talk about the observations of the socialist organizer Oscar Ammeringer, or Ammeringer,
Ammeringer
on the conditions in Oklahoma of as to why the socialists had sort of taken off there.
So Oscar Ammeringer, Ammeringer, however you say it, he had been organizing dock workers in New Orleans, and then he agreed to come to Oklahoma and spread the word of socialism. So what he found was, quote, humanity at its lowest possible level of degradation. So like Nate was saying, these tenant farmers were mortgaged to the hilt. They were living in crude shacks infested with bedbugs and other parasites. They were suffering from the diseases of malnutrition and working in the fields for up to 18 hours a day. So kind of the more established American Socialist Party followed Marxist orthodoxy, and they saw farmers as petty capitalists and argued that agriculture should be collectivized. These kind of new socialist leaders in Oklahoma viewed agricultural laborers as members of the working class and argued that anyone who works the soil has the right to own land. So this didn't really jive with Marxism, but it obviously was a very popular message to these tens of thousands of debt-ridden farmers that just kind of own their small plot of land and were working to their fingers to the bone and not really getting anywhere.
I think that I found it kind of interesting in my head. I was comparing it to the especially post-World War II sort of socialists and Marxist-inspired movements in Latin America, you know, because you'd have these huge, huge tracts of land owned by a very small number of landowners. In some countries, that's still the case today. And the way that the sort of communist rebellions were able to pick up a lot of popular support was by abandoning that view that the small farm the small farmers owning their own land was you know, petty capitalism or whatever, and instead say that land reform and redistribution of land was the way to go, as opposed to collectivization. And of course, like, if you think about it, in Russia, that was also how they initially gained a lot of support, was by promising that they were going to redistribute land from these, you know, this narrow landowning class to the actual farmers working it. The subsequent implementation of that collectivization was generally not very popular, but in the Americas, it seems that this willingness to deviate from that, from sort of the official line on that, and in favor of land reform and land redistribution to smallholders, encouraged a lot of people and made it popular. Now, we've talked about previously that sort of wave of socialists elected around 1911, 1912 in the rest of the country. The wave of socialist involvement and so forth continues in Oklahoma past that. Do you want to talk about what happened in the period, the World War I period before this uprising occurs, 1914 and so on?
Yeah, so 1914, Oklahoma elected 175 socialist candidates to county and township positions, including six to the state legislature, which alarmed the political establishment. And in this lead up to this rebellion, the recently founded working class union recruited thousands of angry, frustrated men in southeast Oklahoma, perhaps as many as 20,000. So these their activities range from legal strikes, boycotts, and lawsuits to night riding, bank robberies, barn burning, and dynamiting farm equipment.
Bit reminiscent of the Australian IWW activities that were happening around the same time period. We alluded to that on our doubleheader episode on anarcho-syndicalism in the United States, because of course the Australian syndicalists eventually founded the Labour Party, but their origins lay in sort of bank robbing and stuff like that, which is, you know, not necessarily the case in the United States for the most part, but clearly there was some strand of that happening in leftism over here as well. So ultimately, according to the Smithsonian, in early August 1917, several hundred rebels gathered by a farm owned by John Spears, who had hoisted the red flag of socialist revolution. Most of the men on Spears Mountain and at other rebel gathering places were members of the WCU, the Working Class Union, a secret socialist organization that vowed to destroy capitalism as well as resist the military draft for World War I. The rebels planned to rout the forces of law and order in Oklahoma, then march to Washington, D.C., where they would stop the war, overthrow the government, and implement a socialist commonwealth. The rebel leaders had assured their followers that 2 million working men would rise up with them, forming an unstoppable army. On the long march east, they would feed themselves with green, i.e. yet to ripen, corn taken from the fields, hence the rebellion's name. When things actually kicked off, and they decided to try to implement this plot, they cut the telephone lines and telegraph lines. They set fire to various railroad bridges and trestles, often unsuccessfully. And one group attempted but failed to dynamite an oil pipeline. On the morning of August 3rd, they mustered on Spears Mountain, also known as Spears Ridge, some 400 strong, and roasted a large quantity of corn and a stolen heifer. Then they waited for Uncle Sam's troops to come or a signal to begin marching to Washington. And that didn't really actually play out that way, as we'll talk about, and ended up dispersing fairly quickly. Again, the part of the context for this is that, you know, this was basically a homegrown and entirely, I would argue, for the most part, homegrown resistance to the American draft and American participation in World War One. But of course, the federal government, as we've talked about on previous episodes, viewed all of this as some sort of elaborate plot by the Kaiser in Germany. And part of the reason for making that connection was that many of the German immigrants in the United States were closely involved in the socialist and anarchist movements in the United States, as we've talked about before. So a lot of the records that we have on this uprising in Oklahoma come from the old German files of the Bureau of Investigation, which is the precursor to the FBI. They had these files on anti-Great War activities, and there are files on this at the National Archives branch in College Park, Maryland. According to the files, it turns out that actually the Working Class Union was filled to the brim with federal informants who knew all their plans from the beginning. So probably this notion that they were going to do a 2 million man long march to Washington, D.C. and overthrow the government was never going to get off the ground to begin with. But interestingly, one of the key tactics that the government used to break this up very early was not as much relying on the informants or on, you know, federal army troops, but actually having a fairly localized response to this. So there's in this Smithsonian article, there's a front page from the Daily Oklahoman in August 1917. And the interestingly, under the biggest headline is obviously the fact that there's this huge government posse being called out against this rebellion. But if you look underneath that, just, you know, a kind of interesting local newspapers used to have world news and could sometimes connect the dots. You have an interesting second largest headline is about the Kerensky government in Russia teetering on the brink. Again, this is, you know, they took power in March our time in 1917 and fell from power to the Bolsheviks in November of 1917 our time. And they were not doing great by August 1917. The local, we talked on our anarcho-syndicalism episode about how often local newspapers were vehemently against any sort of left-wing activity and would, you know, frame it in the most dramatic possible terms. So they described a reign of terror unfolding across Oklahoma with this rebellion that was in progress. But the government instead called out a posse rather than deploying federal troops. That was the expectation that the rebels had, was that they were going to, you know, get into a huge shootout with federal troops. And this would, you know, be the spark lighting the revolutionary fires. Instead, The radicals found themselves confronted with their own neighbors in these government posses, for the most part, and they were a lot less willing to shoot people that they knew personally and didn't have a problem with otherwise, rather than shooting sort of anonymous government troops. And most participants in this uprising refused to talk about it after the fact, even to their own family members. And so it sort of faded quickly from local memory. A lot of totally unconnected Socialist Party of America and IWW members, both in Oklahoma and nationwide, were arrested for purported but non-existent involvement in the uprising, even after it had dissipated pretty quickly. And the idea there was just to arrest all of them, to put them in jail long enough to disrupt whatever they were actually working on. And a lot of them were released pretty quickly due to lack of evidence. But, you know, some of the actual participants, especially if they had killed anyone, which did happen, did some prison time, including some of them in military prison in Kansas. And the sort of afternote to all of this, in January 1920, which is about 2.5 years after the failed uprising, a county draft board member in Oklahoma was ambushed and murdered by radicals, who left a message on his body saying never again would he send men to war. Now, Nate, you had looked at some other sources beyond this Smithsonian article to find some alternative perspectives to some of this, because the article kind of focused more narrowly on some specific incidents and kind of interviewing descendants and relatives of the people involved. So what is some of the other stuff that you found?
Yeah, well, there's a really good monthly review article from about 2010 written by two Oklahomans, including Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's since written a bunch of books, including, I think, Indigenous History or People's History of the United States. And sort of the article goes over how the Green Corn Rebellion has been remembered, often pushed out of, you know, public memory and sort of buried. Maybe it'll get a mention or something in like a Ken Burns type of thing. But she notes that, or they note that there was a novel written about the Green Corn Rebellion, Vanguard Press, William Cunningham, The Green Corn Rebellion, written in 1935, and sort of covers some of the history. And this guy was sort of a Debsian socialist from Oklahoma, but they sort of look at how the history was sort of shaky and didn't quite fully contextualize it in terms of the international struggles of capital. Sort of, it was more of a just like, oh, this is a very American uprising. So they sort of correct the history a little bit on that. But yeah, it's an interesting article, probably too much to go over here, but it does sort of, one part that was interesting was it sort of looks at the Green Corn Rebellion as part of a larger effort and larger various types of activism by the WCU, including, let's see, there was a dynamiting of the Dwar Water Tower the day before the draft took effect. There were anti-draft protests in Seminole Land. There was also in the Chickasaw capital. There was intimidation of neutrals in the Pottawatomie County, secret rendezvous of Reds in El Reno, wildcat strikes in Wilburton. There was an ambush of the Seminole County Sheriff, because there was also lots of Seminoles involved, including, I think there was one who, I think his grandfather was involved in the last war against the U.S. military. So there was a lot of this stuff going on. It wasn't sort of just this one abortive march. There were various trying to cut the telephone and telegraph wires. There were some like attempts to blow up bridges and stuff like that. So there was all sorts of this stuff going on around this time.
For several months before the sort of ultimate uprising. And as you said, I mean, that's the other reason why the newspapers were willing to jump right to saying this was a reign of terror, you know, in progress, was the involvement of Black farmers and Indigenous people in addition to, you know, white tenant farmers or smallholders.
Yeah. And, They sort of sum it up and said, in this light, we might understand the Green Corn Rebellion better if we had called it the Working Class Union Rebellion. And sort of that would be a way to encapsulate all these different actions and expressions of class struggle.
Rachel, final thoughts on this Oklahoma history?
Something else I want to point out is while the establishment part of the Socialist Party at the time kind of shunned religion, the socialism in Oklahoma was very much rooted in kind of that Bible Belt evangelical style of Christianity. So it
Carpenter Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Like Jesus was a socialist, kind of sharing his gifts with his disciples and with the world, basically.
And working class carpenter, exactly. As Nate said.
Yeah, and another Oklahoma State organizer at this time was named Henry Rube Munson, and he is described in this Monthly Review article as a Bible socialist. So it definitely has a huge potential, I think, in the broader picture of current socialism. I know the DSA is trying to bring in leftist Christianity into the fold, because I think now, as then, a lot of the socialist movement is atheist or agnostic. So I think you can bring more people in by kind of going back to that Bible socialism, that working class carpenter Jesus. So I think there's something we can take from that today.
All right, we're going to now talk for the remainder of the episode about another person who was involved in opposing World War I, and this was Oregon United States Senator Harry Lane. So we've talked on previous episodes about some of the lefties from Idaho next door to Oregon. Now we're going to be talking about Harry Lane, who was a very short-lived senator who burned very brightly and was one of the votes against U.S. intervention in World War I. And he is a very interesting figure. I had never heard of him until I was flipping through this book, The Radical Middle Class, Populist Democracy and the Question of Capitalism in Progressive Era Portland, Oregon, which was by Robert Johnston from 2003. Now, without being too mean about it, I will say I don't recommend the book. This was the only part of the book that I found interesting. There's a lot of other things that I really didn't care for, and I won't get into that further, but the Wikipedia page for Harry Lane is actually very heavily sourced to that book, so even after I had returned to the library, it was easy to look up stuff from the book by doing that. The other thing I want to just caveat before we get into discussing some of his positives is that Harry Lane, at least according to this account, was not very friendly toward immigrants, I guess, coming from the tradition, which is not, you know, as we've talked very extensively about immigrant involvement in working class and leftist politics in the United States. But of course, we know that there are some strands of the working class movement and unions and so forth that were not welcoming to immigrants because they viewed immigrants as basically a way of the capitalist class undermining wages and things like that. Again, I want to stress that we have done a whole bunch of episodes about the importance of immigrants in the working class leftist movements, and that many of the folks, especially in the United States, felt that immigrants were an integral part of leftist organizing in the United States. So this is an aspect where this is not a positive for this guy. But other than that, he was a remarkably progressive figure for the time period, and a really interesting guy, so I wanted to talk about him. So Harry Lane, who served from 1913 to 1917 when he died in office, was a pro-communist Democrat, and was maybe one of the most progressive U.S. Officials at a high level that we've ever had. Obviously, we talked about Henry Wallace, the vice president, you know, who's an interesting figure as well on a previous episode. But Harry Lane was an anti-war, anti-imperialist, pro-indigenous sovereignty figure who was briefly in the United States Senate, elected out of Oregon, where he had previously been the mayor of Portland. In his capacity as a United States senator, he opposed U.S. control of the Philippines, opposed U.S. involvement in World War I. He voted against it and participated in filibuster efforts with Robert La Follette Sr. He opposed U.S. involvement in the Mexican Revolution Civil Wars, which we talked about recently on the show. He opposed Woodrow Wilson's unilateral executive actions related to World War I before the U.S. had officially entered the war with the declaration of war. He felt that those were leading the United States inevitably toward that, which is certainly a pertinent echo to today. There was also a speech that he gave, among many controversial speeches in this vein, that he made while serving on the Committee on Indian Affairs. He championed an end to the, quote, civilizing, end quote, policies and pushed for anti-poverty efforts on the reservations, saying, quote, the white man is astride them and is at work taking everything they have, which, of course, was why a lot of people in Oklahoma got involved with the efforts we just talked about there. Lane similarly clashed publicly with the Dixiecrats for any of their horrid statements they were routinely making on black residents in the South, from the Senate floor. He cared very much about both the indigenous rights and the rights of black farmers in the South. This is, again, for context, we're talking about a period around the time of or just preceding the big migration to the North that a lot of black residents made shortly thereafter the Great Migration, as well as there was a significant reform of indigenous policy in the United States in the 1920s under the Coolidge administration. And so this is the immediately preceding period to that. And so he was very vocal about all of this and saying that all of this, racist treatment was racist and ridiculous and not justified by anything. Lane had been elected in November of 1912 and then took office in 1913. He benefited from a six-way split election and spent a total of $75 total campaigning across the state of Oregon, which, you can say, well, adjusted for today's money, I mean, that's still not very much money. There was a whole bunch of different splits among, the anti-left wing candidates, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, so forth. So there was a six-way general election that allowed him to squeak in there as the former mayor of Portland. Senator Lane's de facto chief of staff was his daughter's husband, Isaac McBride, who was a very active member of the Socialist Party of America. And was an unofficial liaison from the senator to the IWW. In very IWW sense, Lane was adamant that antitrust efforts were completely useless. The only solution that he saw to the problem of the corporate trust was the nationalization of natural monopolies, like telephones and telegraphs and mining concerns, and he believed that you could fix the problems of monopoly corporations, or as he called them, big business and crooks, by nationalizing these things. And also, when he had been mayor of Portland, he had advocated for municipal ownership of electric utilities and things like that. Not very successfully, but he had advocated for them. He was also vocally pro-women's suffrage, which was certainly unusual for a lot of the senators at the time, although subsequently, a few years after his death in 1919, Congress approved that constitutional amendment. And then less than 2 months after voting against entering World War I in May 1917, Senator Lane died. Another note, before his Senate tenure, as I said, he was the mayor of Portland for two terms. He struggled there pretty significantly to have much of an effect against the city council and some of the established political machine there. But there were a few things that made him have a legacy that endured well past his, sort of untimely demise. He is mostly remembered today for founding the Rose Festival in Portland, and his other smaller successes were in promoting women to various positions in the administration in Portland, and also setting up a statue honoring Sacagawea, at which he gave a speech denouncing white violence against natives. He also tended to have better luck sending things to ballot questions instead of trying to win policies through council votes. Another note here, the book observes that Harry Lane's grandfather was also a prominent politician in Oregon. He had been the territorial governor of Oregon. He was apparently very horrible to indigenous people. So interesting to see that his grandson made this kind of 180 on that. Rachel, what were your thoughts about this? Had you ever heard of this guy?
No, I have not. I'm kind of unfamiliar with Oregonian politics beyond just knowing that they were founded as a white-only territory, and that kind of has kind of racism and segregation has kind of continued to this present day. So it's kind of encouraging to hear that Harry Lane kind of had a legacy of denouncing this anti-Indigenous, anti-Black sentiment in his state. And something else that I wanted to point out was he, in addition to advancing women's suffrage, he also swore in Lola Baldwin as one of the first female police officers in the United States on April 1st, 1908. Kind of interesting to see how he was kind of on the forefront of advancing women's rights.
Nate, your thoughts on this?
I feel like the name Senator Lane in Oregon like rang some sort of bell, but yeah, I did not know too much about his sort of history, although I feel like he is one of those types of senators that like only sort of existed at this moment early in the 20th century, where like very different than the sort of senators you would see post-war or anything like that. You know, there were like all these small little parties and you know, between the Civil War and I would say World War One, where it was just like, oh yeah, those things existed back then, but not really anymore or at all recently. So very interesting to learn about that history.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to wonder, would he have been reelected if he had survived to, you know,
run, there's like the anti-monopolist parties and like the silver, like free silver parties, like some of these would get like a senator or two. So that was a thing.
Right. You know, I think there was a lot of, you know, propaganda efforts against anyone that opposed the U.S. participation in World War One. And then, of course, we've talked previously about the federal crackdowns on leftist organizers and activists during and after the war as part of the first Red Scare. So, you know, he died almost immediately after voting against the war, and I do wonder whether he would have been able to, you know, hang on to that seat if he had survived to run for a second term. You know, could well have been that he would have really struggled with that. Who knows? I don't know what the sort of climate in Oregon was at the time regarding him.
In the Wikipedia article about him, there was an outcry and there were actually calls for recalling him from office, which was actually obviously rendered moot by his death. An editorial in the Oregonian newspaper stated, "Next to being ashamed of Harry Lane for what he has done, the people of Oregon are ashamed of themselves for having sent Harry Lane to the United States Senate." So although he was lambasted in the press, a friend wrote in a letter that the majority of people insist that you did exactly right. It is the newspapers that are doing most of the kicking. So like you said, although the press was very anti-leftist, I think sentiment was more split than the Oregonian newspaper tried to portray it.
Well, and also, to be fair to the people of Oregon, whether they agreed with him or not, it was a six-way race that got him elected. So you can't say that everyone there elected him. Anyway, yeah, so just kind of an interesting figure with an unusual perspective, and it tied together a whole bunch of the different threads of recent episodes of Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, so I thought that it would be good to talk about him and, you know, fit well with this topic of the draft resistance efforts in Oklahoma in 1917. Rachel, thanks so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
And Nate, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.